Aloha. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, March 31st. The death toll from Friday's earthquake in Myanmar is now above 2,000. We hear about efforts from the local community to help with aid, a bad situation with the civil war now made worse by this natural disaster. Hawaii's fatality count for pedestrians and cyclists is on the rise. The latest efforts behind the push for safer streets. We hear from the Hawaii Bicycling League. And how an earthquake in Alaska could wreak havoc on Hawaii. We learn about new research into the complex dynamics of tsunamis. Plus, what it takes to revive Hawaii's first newspaper. We get the latest on Lahaina Lahuna's high school journalism program. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The latest death toll from the massive quake that hit Myanmar Friday has surpassed the 2,000 mark and is expected to rise dramatically. We reached out to our Burmese community, which gathered last night at Capitol Modern, Hawaii State Museum, for a film screening that quickly turned into a fundraiser for earthquake victims. The 7.7 quake was shallow, which meant it shook the country violently. In the past, the military, the People's Defense Fund, which is now in power, has in the past refused international aid. But this time, it put the call out for help to the international community. We spoke this morning with Mimi Nguyen Bird. She's a community organizer for the Burmese community here in the islands. She tells us there are about 100 families from Myanmar in Hawaii who worry for relatives and friends back home. They're also concerned for the safety of their former leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, and the future of their country.
There are a lot of refugees in the neighboring countries, but also inside the country, there's about 3.5 million internally displaced. So, you know, the environment is already dire, and the people are very vulnerable before this disaster strikes.
And now with this earthquake, and it was a big one, 7.7, and all the aftershocks.
Yes, aftershocks are as big as some of them are 6 point something. So it's continued to rumble because Myanmar, you know, this Myanmar is where the two plates colliding, you know, the one from the India and the one from Eurasia, I think they call it. And it's moving, you know, opposite of each other. And that's where the earthquake is being created.
What can you tell us about the aid? Because in the past, the military has rebuffed efforts. I think there was a flood before, but this time they did put out a call to the international community for help.
Yes. You know, military is unusually call out for help. But when Taiwan Rapid Response Team showed up, they won't allow them to come in. And, you know, and Taiwan has one of the best, you know, response team for this type of disaster. But they accepted China, Russia, and Singapore's help. But also, military has a history of plundering the aid that they receive. I personally was involved in the Cyclone Nargis back in 2008 response, and the U.S. delivered some aid, and we left all our supplies in the Yangon tarmac at the airport, and there were numerous reports of how they were plundered, and they were siphoned off, and it really never got to the victims. And then as late as just recently, when the PDF captured this military warehouse in Rakhine State, there were World Food Program food that is in the warehouse that was kept for the military rations. So whatever aid they get, they're most likely to siphon it off. So that's why we're asking the aid to go through the through the diaspora and the local group directly, if we really want the aid to get to the affected area.
And talk about the situation with USAID, because that normally would be an agency that maybe would have helped in a case like this?
Yes, that would be the USAID. And I think that the embassy is working with that. I am not clear on exactly what's happening there because I'm more involved with the community and the grassroots delivery of aid. But soon after the earthquake hit, you know, the Myanmar Diaspora Network has jumped into action, and we are delivering aid through local on-ground network of organizations. The only thing we have issue is that getting the heavy equipment to lift up, you know, these, you know, blocks of cinder and the people are, you know, under. So that is the hardest piece for us. But getting the food, water, I think it's starting to flow already from the diaspora network.
Okay, but you're not clear on what kind of U.S. aid is reaching the people.
I think that embassy has announced that there's be $2 million will be allocated for the relief. But, you know, I'm not involved with that, so I can't really comment exactly on how that will happen. But the statement did say that it will go through the organizations that are effectively helping with aid. So as for the exact logistics and how they're going to do that, I don't have the visibility on that.
And then the Burmese community had an event this weekend, which really turned into a fundraiser for the earthquake victims. Tell us about the film screening.
Yes, it was a film done by Myanmar actor. It's kind of like an indie film. It's about half an hour. It's called Wide Awake. And it's about, you know, it's based on the trauma the young people have faced since the coup. And it's about, you know, nightmare they have on a daily basis. And we had it planned several months before, but, you know, it just happened right after the earthquake. So it has turned into more of an earthquake relief, a fundraising event.
And so what can people do if they want to help? Where can you direct our listeners?
Yes. So we have these GoFundMe pages that has been activated and that we have verified. And then also there's an Advance Myanmar Emergency, I believe, appeal website. And people can go to that and they can donate because we really need people to donate because it's all grassroots level response for us. So anything will be helpful, but we want to make sure it gets to the victims. So that's why we're asking people to donate through these vetted and verified organizations and websites.
You normally have a spring festival that the community celebrates. Talk about, you know, the events that the community has for this year.
Yes, we are planning for a water festival in April, and I don't have exactly, I think it's around April 19th, but this probably will not be so much celebration, but again, it may turn into just a fundraising event for the earthquake victims. And then later on in June 19th is when Daw Aung San Suu Kyi, who is in jail, she turned 80. And, you know, there's a plan to celebrate her birthday and advocate for her release.
Yes, and it's hard to believe, you know, that she is there in prison. I mean, I recall, you know, her visit to Hawaii not too long ago.
Yes, she came in 2013, I believe, soon after she was released from house arrest. But this time she's not in house arrest. She is in a solitary confinement somewhere in Naypyidaw. And since the earthquake, we have no confirmation of if she's okay. Her son has been going around United States right now trying to appeal for his mother's release.
Yeah, and she was really a symbol of hope for democracy in that country.
Yes, and she still is. And then, and even after the, I don't know if the listeners are aware that even after the earthquake, military continue bombing the villages and towns that are affected by the earthquake. They have as soon as four hours after the earthquake, they resume bombing runs and they continue. And meanwhile, NUG and PDF have said, we want the ceasefire agreement for 2 weeks, and military would not listen to that. And they did not respond and they just continue bombing.
So how does that work now that there's this international effort to aid the victims. Has that changed?
Well, it makes the international aid very difficult, and many of them are trying to go around and trying to support the local organization rather than having to go through the military. But there's certain thing that you can't get in without the, you know, going through the major airport like Yangon Airport to get the equipment in, and that's where then the, you know, military has been obstructing. Right, so we have Taiwan team coming in, and they won't let them in. And we have, they have imposed these arbitrary curfew so that when people are digging through the rubble, because it's so hot during the day, they're working through the night and they will force them to get out. And then another egregious thing is they're going to these volunteer groups and abducting them to put them into the military service, conscription. So they're going around and rounding up these volunteer and response team member and then conscripting them.
Yeah, so that's what you're hearing.
Yeah, that's what we're hearing, okay. Yeah, on the ground.
Okay, well then just keep us posted on you know, any other developments, you know, because it, you know, like I said, it's very hard to verify a lot of the information and the destruction due to the earthquake, you know, because it's only been like a few days.
Yes, but also they have denied, the military has denied foreign correspondent, foreign journalists to go in to report from there. It's what they're trying to do is that they're trying to weaponize this aid and as well as politicize because they want to, they really desperately want to have legitimacy. And they think that if, you know, foreign governments start to have to work with them, that raise their legitimacy.
That was Mimi Winbird, a community organizer who is helping the Burmese community here in the islands. Look for links on our website to learn more how to help.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Oysters play a critical role in filtering pollutants out of seawater. In Australia, scientists are researching how well they'll be able to do that as the ocean gets warmer.
We've taken them all the way up to 33 degrees Celsius. They didn't like it so much, but they were still filtering at about half of their usual capacity.
That story next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing on Maui to help break the cycle of poverty for residents experiencing homelessness, such as HomeAid Hawaii. NereidHawaii.com.
Earlier this month, the Hawaii Bicycling League called attention to the rising death count on our streets of not only bike riders, but pedestrians as well. Sadly, just a few days later, a 7-year-old girl died after she was riding on an e-bike and was struck by a car. Officials say she was not wearing a helmet. And last week, a community bike ride was taken over by a group of teens on motorized bikes who witnesses say broke the rules of the road and even collided with a police car. This morning, we spoke with Travis Council, the executive director of the Hawaii Bicycling League. So far this year, Council tells us there have been 33 fatalities compared to 25 at this time last year.
Our traffic fatalities are certainly headed in the wrong direction, in particular with vulnerable users, those people that are outside of the vehicles, the people walking, biking, on a skateboard, rolling, whatever it might be. You know, as we noted in that press release, we've seen 33 traffic fatalities this year up to date. And last year at this time, it was 25. So we're already increasing from last year's numbers. And the last few years have been above average when you look at kind of a 20-year average as well. So We are seeing fewer fatalities of people in vehicles, thankfully, as cars get safer. But unfortunately, we're seeing that shift to people, again, walking, biking. As you mentioned, our younger population, as well as our kapuna, are the most at risk on our roadways. And it's definitely alarming to see those numbers continue to climb.
Yes. And, you know, there is an effort at the Honolulu City Council and also at the state legislature to try and help regulate the uses on our streets and sidewalks. Talk about the legislation to date that's advancing or what we've been able to get passed.
Yeah, we've seen some great conversations recently. Probably the most recent to take action would be the City Council Bill 52 that was signed in just a month or so ago. Really kind of defines the electric scooters and electric bicycles that we see on the roadways, helps define where they're supposed to be and give the police department a little better tools to regulate what devices can be out there. Of course, a city is a little bit more restrictive on what they can do, so they've looked to the state, helped with some e-bike task force and mobility task force to kind of come up with some recommendations for the state. And I'm happy to report that there are several bills, one in particular, SB 1117, that's moving forward. That's really kind of a comprehensive update to our fairly old or not up-to-date laws and definitions with regards to those different devices that you might see out there, the electric bikes, the electric scooters, the one-wheel devices, those types of things that maybe 10 years ago weren't quite as popular. So quite happy to see those being updated to reflect some of the national trends that we're seeing, as well as some of the local issues that we know HPD and our communities are facing, like those high-speed devices that we saw out in Eva Beach just a couple weeks ago. And those types of things are really some of the aim of this safety bill that we're seeing.
Yes, and that really was quite alarming, that incident in Eva Beach, because, you know, the mayor had just signed that rule into law that deals with behavior on the streets, you know, whether it's popping wheelies or whatnot. But to see this organized ride by, what was it, Bike Factory?
I believe so.
And what started out as just your normal community ride then got hijacked by young people on motorized vehicles.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting to watch something like that, where I think there's clearly an eagerness to have fun and ride together and be out there. And then it is a slippery slope of when it becomes, you know, reckless driving or you know, endangerment in the community and things like that. So thanks HPD for all the hard efforts that they've had, and also recognize that, you know, there's some community behavior and some education. That's where Hawaii Bicycle League comes in with our different education efforts to really just show what's appropriate on our roadways, what might be more beneficial in a parade or in a off-street, you know, less open public space mentality. And it is concerning. You see not only fatalities, but definitely serious injuries. We've heard from EMS and our partners at the Queens and other places of the injuries that are coming in with these higher speed devices. And I guess I want to clarify, you know, it's not all e-bikes. What we consider e-bikes are different than some of these very much so motorcycles that go quite fast. So I think we're definitely seeing concern when it comes to younger riders or inexperienced riders getting on these high speed devices that often most of the time are not even legally allowed on our roadways. And that's concerning.
And, you know, and some of these, I think, are off-roading motorcycles that aren't street legal, but are being ridden on the street. And, you know, with young riders that are going at very fast speeds without helmets. And, and that's another concern, is no protection for your head.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're seeing an effort, and this has happened at the City Council as well, to increase the required helmet age to anybody under 18. It's currently 16 and under. So we're seeing a small increase there. Of course, as a state, we do not have a helmet law for adults. And, you know, we're hopeful to see it's inspiring some younger education to wear a helmet and hopefully have that continue on into adulthood as well. But yeah, that's definitely a concern. The easiest way to protect yourself is to wear a helmet and then, of course, to ride responsibly. So we're hopeful that will continue to be a trend we see of more people wearing helmets. Definitely an important piece.
Yes, and I know that there was some discussion with the Beaky Bikes about whether they would begin, you know, including e-bikes in their offerings of bike racks around Honolulu. But then, yeah, you've got to deal with the helmets as well when you're going at faster
Correct.
Speeds.
Yeah, and a lot of the e-bikes we see, say, within a bike share system really are those lower speed devices, things that are, you know, meant to help you get to work without sweating, but really aren't the ones that are causing, you know, true safety concerns or doing wheelies and things. But the helmets are maintain, you know, the same issue. Even on a traditional bike, we like to see people wear helmets for their own safety. I think I've mentioned before about 50% of crashes happen under your own accord without a vehicle or anything like that. You, you know, hit a pothole or aren't paying attention. So wearing a helmet's not only a good protection against other things that might crash into you, but yourself as well. So helmet usage is something we really encourage across all different ages and devices.
When you look back the past year or so, you know, there was that one couple that were on beach cruisers out on Oahu's west side, and, you know, they were hit by a vehicle. I recall, I think there was someone on a, I don't know if they consider it a unicycle, those one-wheel things, and he was on the freeway, and I think he died as well. And so it really runs the gamut as to what we're seeing with these rising numbers with the fatalities.
Yeah, I mean, one main message we have is, you know, every situation is, of course, different. But a lot of times with these vulnerable users, especially when there's a vehicle involved, you know, protecting yourself, even wearing a helmet or something like that, is a really difficult thing to compete with a multi-pound vehicle. So in the case of Jim and Naomi Meyer and Eva Beach, you know, that was a vehicle that was driving at a high rate of speed that crashed into them while walking across the crosswalk. And really no matter of safety on their side would have prevented that. And that's one of the main messages, is that it's everybody's responsibility, whether you're driving, walking, using the roadway in any ways, to really emphasize that safety. You know, slow down, look for each other, and share the road with Aloha.
And you have a couple of rides coming up this weekend, and then also at the end of the month.
Yeah, so this weekend, April 5th on Saturday, is our annual Zach's Ride for Safe Streets. This is a ride named in honor of Zachary Monago, who actually lost his life to a hit-and-run driver about 15 years ago. And we've taken that tragedy and tried to turn it into something positive, where we really emphasize the need for safe streets. He was a strong advocate for bike lanes and improved bike infrastructure. And so we'll be riding down the King Street protected bike lane and have some speeches downtown from our local officials, as well as family members who have lost loved ones, just emphasizing the need to continue advocating, to continue working together as a community, to really push for safe streets for all. So we invite everybody to come out to that on April 5th. And then at the end of this month, we have our annual Haleiwa Metric Century and Aloha Fun Ride. This is a family-friendly ride, not race, up on the North Shore. You can go anywhere from 2 miles to 60 miles. So we'll have aid stations and food and a lot of fun times up there. So that's April 27th. Just two great opportunities to get out, ride together, celebrate getting out on a bicycle.
And talk about the rides, because it used to be just the regular bicycles, right? But now, since everything's electrified, I mean, are there special rules that you have to accommodate e-bikes?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Yeah, and generally speaking, our rides, since they are rides, not races, we allow things that are legally registered as a bicycle. So that includes our low-speed electric bicycles. And we remind all riders, you know, regardless of what type you're on, to make sure you're not zooming past people unsafely, or that you're communicating well when you're on the road. And this remains true outside of our events as well, whether you're on the bike lane, bike paths, whatever it is, just making sure you're communicating with each other and not startling each other and passing with care. So, yeah, no specific rules on our side other than that they should be registered just like all the other bicycles. So that's our low-speed electric bikes are perfectly permitted in our events.
Okay, and then refresh my memory, because doesn't the Bicycling League have an anniversary this year?
We do, yeah, thanks for that, yeah. So this year is our 50th anniversary. We have a big celebration coming up in June out at Kupu's Ho'okupu Net Shed in Kualo Basin. And we're really excited to celebrate our 50 years, start planning for 50 years more, and pull everybody together to really celebrate the amazing accomplishments in the last 5 decades and hopefully raise some funds to support us moving forward as well.
All right. Okay. Well, happy anniversary.
Thank you very much.
But thank you so much for your time this morning, Travis.
Of course.
That was Travis Council, Executive Director of the Hawaii Bicycling League, talking to us about the recent push to keep our streets safer as we begin to see the proliferation of motorized scooters and electric bikes, in addition to other devices like Segways and one-wheelers across the state. Head to our website for links about the Safe Street Ride this Saturday and the Haliva Metric Ride at the end of the month. This is a conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. This past weekend, we lost acclaimed actor and longtime Hawaii resident Richard Chamberlain. His publicist says his passing was related to complications due to a recent stroke. So today we're paying tribute to him with our backyard quiz. Chamberlain may be best known as being the king of the miniseries for his lead roles in the 1980 adaptation of Shogun and the Thornbirds. People here in Hawaii may also remember him for playing the lead in a television series filmed here on Oahu with this theme song. Now, if you're thinking, hey, that's the Consolidated Theater's opening hula sequence, you'd be close, but wrong. For today's backyard quiz, what Richard Chamberlain TV series was that opening theme music from? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing solutions for homeless residents living on the island of Maui, such as Home Aid Hawaii, NareitHawaii.com.
President Trump loves to insult people with demeaning nicknames. Well, wait until he hears what the Chinese call him.
Chuan Jianguo, which basically means Trump helps build the Chinese nation. And over the past several weeks, a new nickname, Te Mei Pu, which means super clueless.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, the view from China on Donald Trump's return to power. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hemic, a mutual insurance company, helping care for Hawaii's businesses and workers for more than 20 years. Learn more at hemic.com.
News of the devastating earthquake in Myanmar has us looking inward at Hawaii's own vulnerabilities. While the island of Hawaii is particularly susceptible to earthquakes, the state is at risk from another natural disaster, tsunamis. Fai Chung is a professor at the University of Hawaii at Manoa who researches the link between earthquakes in the Aleutian Islands in Alaska and tsunamis in Hawaii. He spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about his team's new research into the history of these destructive tsunamis, starting with a crash course on how tsunamis and earthquakes occur.
Let me just use Hawaii as an example. Tsunamis can be generated around the Pacific, but the Aleutian Islands or the Aleutian subduction zone is nearest to Hawaii. So the subduction zone is formed when the Pacific plate subduct beneath the North American plate. And the subduction is not continuous because part of the plate at some locations, the two plates are stuck to each other. So the Pacific plate would keep pushing down and stress will build up in the overriding plate until the stress becomes too large and the two plates snap. And when the plate snap, we kind of push the water up and water doesn't like gravity, so it will go down and tsunamis are generated.
And there are examples of tsunamis occurring in Hawaii's history. Maybe give a brief overview into some of the history there.
Yes, there have been five destructive tsunamis in Hawaii during the recorded history of about 200 years. And the most severe tsunami was in 1946, and that tsunami came from the Aleutian Island. 11 years later, another Aleutian tsunami inundated the coastline of Hawaii. So these are the two most severe tsunamis in the last 200 years. The subduction is a continuous process, and the two plates snap at intervals of maybe 100 to several hundred years, a major earthquake. So in order to find out how big a tsunami that might happen in the future, we need to look at the past. But the problem is that we have only 200 years of recorded history of tsunami impact in Hawaii. But tsunamis are generated by earthquakes with a geological time scale. So we are talking about a time scale of several hundred years. So that's the reason why, in addition to collaborating with a seismologist, I also collaborate with geologists who look into the ground and find out layers of a marine deposit to determine tsunamis occurred several hundred years ago before we have historical record. So the paper that you came across was a collaboration between tsunami modelers, seismologists, and coastal geologists. The coastal geologists examined the sand deposit in the coastal area and identified three major tsunami events in the Aleutian Islands in the last 700 years. And they also identified a layer of sand in Hawaii from a similar camp. So our research was to recreate the tsunamis through computer simulation to find out what kind of earthquake happened during the last 700 years. So now with a longer time history of earthquakes, we can make a better prediction of what might happen in the future.
And one of the striking things you found was this 14th century earthquake and tsunami event that you think even exceeded the level of inundation that the 1957 one caused in Hawaii. So tell us more about how you came to that conclusion and what that means.
Okay. So my geologist colleagues discovered three sand layers in the Aleutian Islands. And they also have deposit data in Hawaii. And they find out a layer in Hawaii in the 14th century with the same age as one of the layers in the Aleutian. So the interesting thing is that they were able to go back 700 years in Hawaii to identify one sandy deposit at the shore. And the other two are because there were three prehistoric tsunamis in the past 700 years from the Aleutian deposit, but only one in Hawaii, the 14th century. So we did the modeling and we find out one interesting aspect in the tsunami deposits and preservation in Hawaii. That is, in order for tsunami deposit to be preserved naturally in Hawaii, it has to be a major event. with sufficient sand transported in them. So this is kind of an important finding from the geology point of view. But for estimating the size of the future tsunami, that event kind of set a benchmark. It is how big a tsunami that have occurred in the last 700 years. And that provide reference when we estimate what would be a low probability event in the future or a worst case scenario. Having a sequence of events in the Aleutian kind of tell us how often those major earthquakes occur. And the finding to me is a good news for Hawaii, because earthquake occur at an interval of 100 to 300 years, releasing the stress instead of building up for 1,000 years like a pressure cooker, and you don't know when it will snap.
And so the fact that there were these two almost back-to-back tsunamis in 1946 and 1957, well, then maybe we won't see another destructive one for a while.
So you need to dig a little deeper to answer this question from the paper. An important finding of the paper is that the entire interface does not snap at the same time. It has a sequence. The shallow part will snap, and then a couple of hundred years later, the deeper part will snap, and then it go back to the shallow part of the interface. So the 1946 and 1957, they occur along the shallow part of the interface. So this means the stress in the shallow part of the interface was released recently, geologically. And so now we know the next event will more likely be the deeper part of the interface. And that would correspond to the 14th century event, which ruptured at the deeper part of the interface.
But we don't necessarily know when that will happen.
We don't know. So I have to be very careful not to predict, because I cannot. But if you look at the cycles, the 14th century is the deeper part of the interface. And then the 15th century event is in the shallow part. We have another one in the 18th century that is in the deeper part of the interface. And 1957 is in the shallow part. So between the 18th century and 1957, it's about 200 years. Yeah, so the next one would be in the next couple of hundred years. And that, according to, if we follow the trend of the data, that will be in the deeper part.
It seems like you think about tsunamis a lot as part of your job. Is there anything that you've learned about tsunamis that you want everyone to know?
I think it's the devastating power of the flow. And let me tell you a story. And this kind of illustrates why tsunami waves are a lot more severe than the waves that you see when you go to the beach. So I think it was 2010, there was a tsunami event coming from Chile. And the deputy director or the vice director of civil defense called me up in the middle of the night and woke me up and woke up my wife and asked me to go to the emergency operations center to advise. And the director told me that they're expecting a tsunami waves of several feet. So I told my wife, oh, I need to go to the emergency operations center because we are expecting a tsunami wave of several feet high. And my wife said, what's the big deal? We see that in the ocean all the time. Then I explained to her, the waves that you see in the ocean, they come and go within 10 seconds. But a tsunami wave would keep coming for 10, 15 minutes. Even though we are talking about several feet, the damage can be very significant.
Yeah, I can imagine some people hearing a tsunami wave of several feet, and instead of evacuating, the first thing they do is grab their surfboard. So not the kind of thing you want to surf.
No. I think that is a common misunderstanding in the community, because not many people have seen a tsunami before, but they have seen the waves in the ocean and they could not appreciate the damaging power of a tsunami.
That was University of Hawaii Manoa researcher Kwok Wai Chong. He spoke with HBR's Maddie Bender. His newest research was published in the journal Nature Communications, and we will have a link to it on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
On the next Fresh Air, British actor Stephen Graham, who's starring in two new shows. In the Hulu series 1,000 Blows, he plays a real-life bare-knuckle boxer fighting in Victorian London. And in Netflix's Adolescence, he plays the father of a 13-year-old boy arrested for murdering a classmate. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
And now it's time for the answer to today's backyard quiz. Richard Chamberlain's acting career took off in the 1960s when he landed the lead role in the television series Dr. Kilgore, for which he won a Golden Globe Award. But he may be best known for his work in the TV adaptations of Shogun and The Thornbirds, landing him the nickname the King of the TV miniseries. Chamberlain had been a part-time Hawaii resident for years before he passed away at his home in Waimanalo this past Saturday. And we've been told he would often call HBR2 host and music director Gene Schiller on occasion to talk about classical music. Earlier, we asked you for the name of the Richard Chamberlain television series with a theme song that sounds like the Consolidated Theater's opening hula sequence. Well, if you were tuned into network TV in 1989, you may have watched Chamberlain as Dr. Daniel Kulani on Island Sun, which was filmed here on Oahu, which was the answer we were looking for. We had many people call up, but nobody won. And we should note that Chamberlain's birthday is actually today, the 31st of March, and he would have turned 91. That's our quiz for today. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
When you support HPR, you support classical music and all its benefits.
Melvin Yee, neurologist here in Honolulu, longtime HPR member, your love for guitar that you're sharing for us tonight on our evening concert.
What I always tell my patients who are worried about their cognitive ability as they age, that one should always try to keep your mind active.
There are many studies about the health benefits of music on your health and well-being.
Yes, it's very peaceful and calming. And then when I play the guitar, I can just focus on that. Forget all the other concerns and just work on playing the music.
Support classical music on HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
HPR reporter Cassie Ordonio has been taking a look at the state of newspapers in our public high schools. Today she has news of how one school is resurrecting its journalism program and publishing online. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
So, sign of the times, huh?
Yep, it's been 8 years since Lahaina Luna High School had a student newspaper, with the last publication going back to 2017. But that publication was called Kaleo Luna, or The Voice of Lahaina Luna. But one English teacher named Jarrett Chapin took notice of its absence and wanted to revive the program, and along with it, he revived Hawaii's first newspaper in the state, but also west of the Rockies, and that's called Kalama Hawaii. And why Jarrett Chapin wanted to revive the journalism program is because he noticed a lack of media literacy among his students, where his students are getting most of their information on social media like TikTok or Instagram. And so he was concerned about it, but also because he taught on universities on the continent, he noticed that there's always been this kind of emphasis in universities and public schools on STEM rather than the arts or humanities, and journalism is one of them. And so he's afraid that journalism, for example, is going to become more for the elite, but media literacy and journalism should be accessed to all students. But when he was getting started on starting the program, he noticed that his students were more familiar with writing essays. And he said the challenge was getting his students actually excited to do this type of writing rather than submitting essays that's only going to be seen by one person, which is that teacher who's grading it. So he wanted to raise the stakes a little bit higher. So he actually calls journalism high stakes writing, where it's factual writing, where students can do news writing and talk to real life people and students, but have it open to like public readership. So that kind of raises the stakes in what he's talking about. But he wanted to pay homage to this last school newspaper, which is Kalama Hawaii. So they agreed to kind of pay homage to that history. And Jarrett spoke about what it means to bring back the newspaper in an online form.
We are the birthplace of several of the first, you could say, minority histories or first indigenous histories of Hawaii. David Malo wrote The Antiquities. He was in the first graduating class of Lahaina Luna. Samuel Kamakau also wrote a series of letters that would later become another sort of landmark text in Hawaiian history. The Fornander histories were based on interviews with Lahaina Luna graduates primarily. Lahaina Luna has been at the center of Hawaiian literacy since pretty much the beginning of the kingdom, and I don't think people are talking about it enough. And so it seems like a revitalization like this, or bringing back the name of the paper, the paper named as such, is kind of a no-brainer.
So Kalama Hawaii was published in February 1834. It did have like a short-lived life. This last publication dates back to 1841. It was originally a 9-by-11-inch sheet of paper. Although the paper was specific to Lahaina Luna, it was widely read throughout the Hawaiian kingdom. And around that time, this is when Hawaiians quickly embraced literacy. It had a short run because of a mix of factors. There was the decline of the Hawaiian language and an increase of the English language, and there was also this changing political and social landscape. But before, students back in Lahaina Luna Seminary, before Lahaina Luna became a high school, or Lahaina Luna High School, students would write about Christianity, the Bible, some essays. They'll even write about different animals like horses and hyenas, for example, which would always be on the front page of every weekly issue. But students at Lahaina Luna High School now, they're writing news stories about the math proficiency rates and how it's impacted students since the COVID-19 pandemic, parking issues, teacher shortages, and more. I spoke to Kayla Jimenez, who's a sophomore at Lahaina Luna High, and she said she's gaining new skills as a writer, but has faced challenges that many of us have faced while doing our jobs.
The biggest struggle for me was interviews, not just the content, because first of all, it's like an art writing questions that provide good content. And also just getting, some students don't want to be involved in that, and that's reasonable, but it's my job to find them or find the students that do want to talk. And it's really hard sometimes. And so especially when most articles have a lot of interviews, it gets kind of overwhelming. I think that's my biggest struggle. But some things I found I strive in is the writing process, because I think that goes by really smoothly for me because I like writing.
I also spoke to Jersey Borneman, who's also a sophomore, and while she doesn't see herself going into journalism, she developed a new skill, and here's what she thinks about the class.
I just think it's really great that, like, we actually get to give a voice to kids on our campus and their opinions. And when they have problems, like, we can write about it and hopefully something will be done. And I just think that's such, like, an amazing opportunity.
What a great thing for that teacher, Jarrett Chapin, to do. Awesome.
And the fact that, like, he has no experience in journalism, but he's just a passionate English teacher.
Yeah, good for him. All right. We need more journalists.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. We've been talking to Cassie Ordonio. She had a story about a Lahaina high school resurrecting its school newspaper. Look for her stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear from the Office of Consumer Protection how the bankruptcy of the popular genetic testing company 23andMe raises privacy concerns, what you can do to address them. Have a story idea to share with us? Call our talkback line 808-792-8217. Find the conversation on our website or on Spotify, Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.